Jamuna Tira Vanachari. Jamuna Tira Vanachari. Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Vihari. Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Vihari. Gopi Jana Vallava Girivara Dhari. Gopi Jana Vallava Girivara Dhari. Yashoda Nandana Vraja Janaranjana. Yashoda Nandana Vraja Janaranjana. Jamuna Tira Vanachari. Jamuna Tira Vanachari. Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Vihari. Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Vihari. Jayam Vishnupad Paramahamsa Parivrajaka Acharya Stotara Satsi Simari Si Bhakti Vedanta Swami Prabhupada Ki Jai Samaveta Bhaktivrinda Ki Jai. All glories of the assembled devotees. Gaur Premanandi Hari Hari Bo. Hare Krishna. So I'd like to personally welcome all of our guests and thank you all for coming. As all of you must know, yesterday there was as Fox News called it, a tragedy in the sky. And I was asked to speak tonight about that and how, from a Krishna conscious perspective, we understand it, how we respond to it, both intellectually and emotionally. Of course, all of us do respond in a particular way, and that's the way we respond to it. But in a sense, the purpose of cultivating a spiritual life, the purpose of participating in spiritual activities, is to try to elevate oneself, to improve oneself, to refine oneself, and certainly in the test of one's achievement spiritually is how one responds to significant and powerful, emotionally powerful events. Not merely, of course, I suppose how you respond to trivial things also says something about your spiritual consciousness. But still, in this particular case, we have something which is not trivial, which is important, and so I've been asked to speak about that. So, first I want to try to place it within a context, not, in this case, not a political context or a scientific context or an economic context, as you see on the news, because that's not what I do for a living. Actually, I'm not paid to give this lecture either. I don't do this for a living either, but in any case, it's appropriate that in this particular time and place that we try to understand these events within a spiritual context. And by spiritual here, of course, we mean not merely having the right feeling about it, but also the right understanding. After all, if you consider the word philosophy, the very word philosophy, if we look at its Greek origin, means the head and the heart, because after all, Sophia is the Greek word for wisdom. And so that says something about our intelligence. But the word philo, love of wisdom. So love is an emotion. Love comes from the heart. So the very word philosophy, I mean, there's not a lot of heart in some contemporary Western philosophy. It can get pretty dry. And in fact, now in universities, philosophy departments advertise their major by saying that it's a good preparation for business school or law school, since philosophers are not in high demand right now. And I think deservedly so, because of the particular materialistic bent they've been on for a few centuries. But we won't get into that now. The point I want to make is that real philosophy has to do with the head and the heart. It has to do with an understanding and an emotional attitude, a feeling about reality as one understands it. So we're going to talk about philosophy, not in a dry sense, hopefully, but philosophy as a type of wisdom and the types of feelings, the type of love that is appropriate in response to that wisdom, that understanding. So we're going to try to do real philosophy here tonight and then apply that to the events which just took place. So I'm going to not simply talk about abstract philosophy, but I'll begin by laying the groundwork, at least for this discussion, by referring to the Bhagavad Gita, which is, of course, our basic philosophical text, the Bhagavad Gita, which Lord Krishna himself speaks. In the Bhagavad Gita, we find, in the very beginning of Lord Krishna's teaching, in chapter 2, that Krishna, I don't want to say is at pains to do something, because God is not really in pain. That's, anyway, a difference between our understanding and other religious understandings. But God is not really in pain. But Krishna is going to some trouble, or is very carefully laying out a first and essential philosophical point, and that is that we ourselves are spiritual beings. Spirituality, spiritual knowledge, spiritual existence is never something which ultimately is extrinsic to us, which is outside of us. It's our very nature, the essence of what we are. We are essentially spiritual. And by that, Krishna means that we are a real existing thing, a real spiritual substance, a soul which is characterized most strikingly by consciousness. And in contrast to what we essentially are, namely spiritual beings, there is another type of real thing that exists, and that is called matter, or material nature. And that is characterized strikingly by its unconsciousness. And of course, matter is, say, the seat I'm sitting on, or the floor, or whatever you're sitting on. I don't know if whether you've got a chair or a cushion, or just a few squares of marble there, but anyway, probably at least since the philosopher Kant, has become very popular to say things like "don't use people." We say "don't use people" as if there's an ethical problem with merely using people, seeing them as a means to my ends, and not regarding them in any way as having their own purposes as conscious beings. But there's no ethical problem with saying that you're using that chair. If someone accuses me of using this seat as if I'm doing something unethical, it wouldn't make sense, because there's a fundamental difference between the seat and the person sitting on it. There's a fundamental difference between every seat. Let's say, assuming they are dead seats, let's not say we're not talking about some decadent kingdom where people sit on other people. So Krishna is making this crucial distinction. There is such a thing as dead matter. There is such a thing as dead, non-living, unconscious matter. And we use it, and we have no ethical problem merely using matter. Whether we're talking about pencils or cushions or toothbrushes or cars, whatever. At the same time, there are people who, in contrast to matter, are alive and conscious. And Krishna makes an obvious point in the Bhagavad Gita. He says, it's better to be conscious than to be unconscious. It's better to be alive than to be dead. And therefore, Krishna calls the living conscious energy his superior energy. So, of course, in the Gita we also learn, I've just said something which bears an explanation. Everything that exists, aham krishnasya jagatak. Anyway, Krishna says everything that exists is the energy of God, or is my energy, Krishna speaking as God. So everything in the universe belongs to God, is God's energy, as much as your own energy, in a sense, is yours. I mean, the very notion of freedom, if you think in any way it is a natural law, or in any way it is merely natural or proper, correct, that people be free, then you must believe that people are ultimately the proprietors, the owners of their own energy. Whether it's their body, their kinetic energy, their ability to move. And of course, we know you can't, your freedom doesn't mean you can go kill someone. But within the boundaries of appropriate, healthy behavior, we do have a natural right to be free. And that's because people are naturally the proprietors of their own energy. Now, if you consider that there is someone among us, God or Krishna, who is the creator of all energy, that everything that exists is God's energy, it follows by a type of natural law that everything belongs to God. And so Krishna explains in the Gita that this is the case, and that among the things he has manifested or created in this world, there are basically two energies. One is better than the other because it's alive and conscious. So there's a simple point. Now, what we are talking about here in Vedic or Sanskritic philosophical jargon would be called paramarthika, which means it's a discourse about the ultimate mean of things, parama artha, the highest meaning. At the same time, Vedic culture, thank God, has common sense. And Vedic culture recognizes that you can't always be thinking directly about the highest things. For example, if you're trying to get into a college and you have to fill out an application, inevitably, the first question on almost any application is, in India they would call, your gotra. What is your family lineage? In America we call it last name. Your gotra. So the first question is, what's your last name? So if you say, well, ultimately I have no last name, I'm a pure spiritual being. And if they say, where were you born? And then you quote from the Gita, the soul is never born, the soul has always existed. It's a nice meditation, but you're not going to successfully apply for many things. You won't have many credit cards, or you won't be involved in many institutions like schools. So the Vedic culture has common sense. The Vedic culture recognizes that sometimes we can't simply restrict ourselves to this paramarthika dimension of life. And therefore, there's another word, vyavaharika, from the Sanskrit word vyavahara, which roughly means intercourse, social intercourse, just day-to-day life, ordinary worldly business. So this distinction has always been recognized either by the terms paramarthika and vyavaharika, also by the terms vaidika and laukika, Vedic and worldly. To give an example of this, in a story which is well known to those of you who know Krishna consciousness, there's a famous pastime of Krishna when he was on this earth 5,000 years ago, where he lifted up a great hill, Govardhan Hill, in Vrindavan, the Vrindavan area. So this incident began when Krishna noticed that his father was preparing to worship certain, I guess what in the West they would call nature gods. In this case, Indra, basically the Vedic Zeus, god of rain and thunder. The word Zeus, of course, from Sanskrit, as you may know. Zeus is just Deus, Devas, from Sanskrit. And just like Jupiter. Jupiter is also from Sanskrit. It's simply Jupiter, the father of heaven. Jupiter, which it becomes in Roman Jupiter. Anyway, so Krishna, one of the main tasks that Krishna took upon himself when he appeared in this world was to persuade people not to engage in polytheism. Contrary to popular and erroneous perceptions of the ancient culture of India, it is not polytheistic. You can say it's a polytheistic in the sense that the Old Testament is polytheistic, that there are many gods. For example, the first commandment. What is the first commandment of the Ten Commandments? You shall have no other god before me. Now, if there were no other gods, that wouldn't be a relevant commandment. So the very first commandment of the Ten Commandments recognizes that, in fact, there are other gods. They're just not supreme, and they're not to be worshipped. Only the supreme god is to be worshipped. Similarly, we also find in ancient Vedic culture that there's a recognition of the obvious, that within the wide universe there are many heaven, there are many powerful beings, but there's one supreme god. This is a powerful understanding found explicitly in the most important Vedic literature, and now somewhat misunderstood, if not entirely forgotten, by people claiming to follow Vedic literature in different parts of the world. But anyway, Krishna wanted to explain that we are not to be polytheistic, because polytheism is philosophically nowhere, because there's no synthesis, there's no resolution. I mean, the very notion of being rational is to understand what is the one behind the many, what is the principle behind the... Anyway, being a little bit off base here. But Krishna did say in that pastime, speaking about his father's preparation to worship one of the many gods, is this ceremony laukika or vaidika? Is it Vedic or worldly? So you have these distinctions. Hare Krishna, are you going to go forward? Or maybe you could just wait. We're in the middle of a lecture here. Thank you. So this distinction of Vedic or transcendental or spiritual and worldly is a very ancient distinction. It's one that Krishna himself makes. Now, getting back to the recent tragic events, Krishna explains in Bhagavad Gita that to practice yoga, to be engaged in spiritual life, we cannot be extremist or fanatic, either on the material side or even in pursuit of the spiritual. We cannot be extremist. For example, could you wait till the lecture's over before you go forward? Thank you. In other words, Krishna says, don't eat too much. In the Bhagavad Gita, if you want to practice yoga, if you want to practice spiritual life, don't be a glutton. Don't eat too much. Well, that's common sense. But then Krishna says, don't eat too little. In other words, don't say, well, I'm really an eternal soul, I'm not this body, so I'm not going to feed this body. Krishna says, don't eat too much, don't eat too little. Don't sleep too much, don't sleep too little. So this moderation, what Krishna calls yukta, yuktahara, viharasya, yukta chestasya, and so on. This moderation, what the Greeks called the golden mean, applies not merely to physical activities, it applies to emotional activities. It applies to emotional activities. An example of Krishna's application of moderation to emotional or intellectual activities is found in the Gita when Krishna says that if someone is attached to working in this world, don't confuse them by insisting that they give up these activities, but show them how to channel these activities in a spiritual way. And specifically what Krishna says in chapter 3 of the Gita is, Navudi Bhedan Janiyate, literally don't produce or don't generate literally in someone, don't create in someone a incoherence, a split in their understanding so that they become sort of, metaphysically bipolar. In the sense that, or overly conflicted, in the sense that they're attached to material things, but you're really pushing them hard. No, this is all illusion. Go for the spiritual. And they end up kind of dysfunctional because they can't do one or the other. They can't give up the material things, but they feel guilty about them. And it just becomes a mess. It becomes a psychological mess. In fact, I would suggest that one such psychological mess actually had something to do with the Reformation, which took place in Europe in the 16th century. But anyway, that's another topic. So, the point here is this, that we have material bodies, and the bodies are not merely physical, there's an emotional side to the material body. Because matter, or the material world, in the yoga system, it's not merely the physical elements like earth and water, the solids and the liquids and the fire, but there are material emotions. There is a type of worldly cognition, a worldly perception of things and worldly emotions that go with them, which are part of being in the world. It's part of being in this world. It's part of having a material body and a material mind. And so because we're in this world, because we're conditioned by this material body and mind, and so on, because we're attached to this world, all of us to some extent, still, therefore when events take place, like for example a great tragedy, and we see people that we really want to be safe tragically dying and so on, and we understand the grief of their families. The point I want to make here is that we cannot merely react to it in a worldly way, in an emotion, in according to worldly emotions, and become sort of inconsolable and just sort of unlimited grieving. At the same time, we cannot simply ignore our emotions. We cannot pretend that, well, nothing really happened because we're all eternal and so it's a trivial event. This is the point I'm trying to make. That if we look at Krishna's Bhagavad Gita, if we look at the strategy he enunciates of how to live well in this world with material attachments but with spiritual knowledge, one who's trying to work their way or trying to advance to the point of powerful spiritual understanding, then we have to acknowledge, we have to recognize the emotions we feel, not simply deny them, and channel them spiritually. I mean, an example of this, some of us, especially those of us who are sort of dinosaurs from the 60s, we know who we are. People from the 60s, I think, sometimes are notorious for not understanding that 4 decades have passed. But anyway, the reason I mention this is because I was going to say something nice about the president, and people of my generation have been trained rigorously never to say anything nice about a Republican president. So I'm going to break with tradition and custom and say something nice about a Republican president. And that is that he sort of gave an example of what I'm talking about. I mean, he's not a member of the Hare Krishna movement, and I'm not a cattle rancher. But so we may approach this in a somewhat different way. But still, there was something instructive about what he said. He made a speech the day of this tragedy. And read in the paper today that on the advice of a lady who was a close associate of his and a former advisor, he added a verse from Isaiah, the prophet Isaiah. They look to the stars and so on, and to be conscious of the maker of the stars. I also thought that he used the reference from the Old Testament, which is, of course, very important to serious Christians, because there was an Israeli astronaut on board, and so I thought it was actually quite a deft bit of diplomacy also to quote from the Old Testament so that everyone could feel good about it. But anyway, the idea, he said, is that these astronauts didn't come back. They didn't come back to Earth, but we can pray that they went home. I won't. This is a very powerful statement, I think, and whoever it's coming from, it's a powerful statement, and there's a good deal of truth in it. Our real home is in the spiritual world. I'll just mention in passing, I won't dwell on it, that this whole way of thinking that there is a spiritual world, which is our real home, actually came to Christianity to some extent through Greek philosophy influenced by Vedic culture, but that's another discussion, if you know the history of Christian philosophy. But the point I want to make here is that if we look at the picture of these astronauts, almost all of whom were attractive people, still from my point of view, young, attractive people who were enthusiastic and in their own way trying to do something good. There's something about these people which we can recognize as good. They may not strictly belong to our religious movement. They may not agree with us on points of philosophy. They may engage in some activities we might consider inappropriate, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But still, it's God's creation, and there's something recognizably good about these people. There's something even recognizably good about what they're doing. It may be a materialistic attempt to explore the universe, but at least they're not. It's an attempt at knowledge. It's an attempt to gain knowledge. And so even if it's not a perfect attempt, it's an attempt. And so there is something good. There's something, they have families. And the emotions of their families, I mean, they're emotions that we also have. There are many ways in which we can empathize with these people and not merely erect high barriers thinking that we're transcendentalists, we belong to a different culture. After all, our philosophy is one and different. There are obvious ways in which we are different culturally from the people that were on that shuttle. There are obvious ways in which we are culturally different. But there are obvious ways in which we are not different. And it seems to me that in general, not only the success of our movement, but our own individual success in just being emotionally healthy and spiritually healthy, our own success in having good lives, from our own perspective, depends upon our ability to make relevant distinctions. After all, if there's no way in the world in which it's better to do what we're doing, then why would we do it? And so to be strongly fixed in one's spiritual life, one obviously has to know what's better about a spiritual life than a material life. And one has to specifically understand what's better about spiritual life the way we're doing it. We don't think everyone else is a heathen going to hell. We're not fanatical in that sense. But obviously, if I'm here doing this and not something else, it would be ingenuous, silly of me to claim that I don't think there's something better here, and I do. At the same time, according to Lord Chaitanya's philosophy, I would argue according to Lord Chaitanya's philosophy, it is equally important for us. It is equally important for us to understand the ways in which we are not different from other people. Because after all, Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, what is the symptom of the wise, the panditas? The symptom of the wise is not that they see what they're doing as better than what everybody else is doing. That's actually not what Krishna says in that context. He says the symptom of an enlightened person is an enlightened person sees the equality of everyone. So the power... Could you wait? Could you just wait till the lecture is over? Thank you. Part of our culture. Even in Sanskrit, you have these two words, samasa and vyasa. Asa means to place in Sanskrit. Samasa means to put things, to place things together. So to be wise, you have to have the power to put things together. And vyasa, the power to place them apart. That's why Vyas is called Vyas, because he divided the Vedas. He separated things. So that's Vyasa, and then there's Samasa. You have to put things together also. We have to make distinctions, but we have to see the oneness, the unity, the equality of all beings. That's the symptom of wisdom. And we can't be, to use an old word from, what is that, Holland Caulfield, what was that old book, Catcher in the Rye. We can't be phony. If people, could you wait till, could someone please tell the people at the door that there's a lecture going on, because they may not notice. Let's be honest. You may be a member of the Hare Krishna movement. You may chant Hare Krishna. You may be initiated once, twice. You may be a leader of the Hare. But if your relatives tragically died, I mean, God forbid, it would mean something to you. It would affect you. So why trivialize the feelings of other people if we, in fact, have those same feelings? And we even find that people in the scriptures have those same feelings. So there is... It seems to me, in fact, that unless there is powerful empathy on our part, after all, we who are claiming that everyone is part of God, we should have the greatest powers of empathy. And it's precisely by that empathy, by really feeling what other people feel, by really being able to identify at some level with everyone, it's by establishing the connection that we can then elevate people. You can't lift someone up if you're not connected to them. If you're not in some way connected, holding on to them, how can you elevate them? How can you help them? So if this movement aims to lift up humanity, which is a modest goal, if this movement really aims at lifting up humanity, we'd better be connected to humanity. We'd better be connected. And how can there be a connection... if there's no sympathy, do you like to be intimately connected with people that have no sympathy for you? After all, the word yoga means connection. Sorry about that. I was choked on it. So, the main point of the Gita is that we all need to get into a connection. We need to be linked to God, to Krishna. We need to connect ourselves to Krishna, to God. And the whole principle of parampara, of guru, parampara, is that if someone is connected to God, and if that person is compassionate, and if they're really connected to God, I mean, how could they not be compassionate? That person needs to establish yoga with everybody else. I mean, isn't that what Prabhupada did? Prabhupada was most intimately linked to Krishna in yoga. And what did he do? He came to this world and linked himself to millions of people. And how did he do that? By his ability to enter everybody's heart, to feel what they were feeling, to know what they were thinking, to self-evidently be their most caring friend. So therefore, if we only have the power to distinguish ourselves from other people, and that's as far as we go, there's a word for that in the Bhagavatam. It's called third-class devotee. That's actually the word for it. Again and again and again, you find in the Bhagavatam the symptom of a devotee of Krishna who's not liberated, who's not transcendental, who's mundane. A mundane devotee, and you will find this word right in the Bhagavatam, available wherever better books are sold. Right in the Bhagavatam, you will find the term Prakrita Bhakta, a mundane, a materialistic devotee. And the main symptom, that person does see God or Krishna in the temple, but does not see that same deity in every living being. So, if we merely distinguish ourselves and do not see the oneness, if we don't feel how we are truly one with everyone, we don't get it. we don't get Krishna consciousness. And there is something, I think, horribly hypocritical about ourselves feeling emotions when we suffer a great loss and then trivializing the great loss of other people. There's something terribly hypocritical and almost cruel about that. And so, therefore, I think we have to connect with people. We have to understand how they feel. There should be tremendous sympathy on our part and a sense of loss. Because after all, if it's not a bad thing to be in the material world, why try to get people out of it? And so to see soul suffering is something which should move a great soul, which does move great souls. So it's this combination, it's this balance that I began talking about. On the one hand, being spiritually connected, ultimately seeing things spiritually, but recognizing our own emotions, empathetically and sympathetically recognizing the emotions of others, being true friends to other people, and not merely arrogant, spiritual chauvinists. But actually, I mean, having that tremendous empathy and then helping people in their grief. Because counseling people, encouraging people, consoling people who are grieving forever has been one of the main duties of religious leaders. And it always will be. So, those are some of the things I wanted to say about this. About what I think, because to be healthy, we have to be balanced. And I think that this is a clear example where there needs to be balance. Not simply to grieve as if we don't know the soul is eternal, but not to be indifferent to the feelings of others and to our own feelings about it, which are to some extent natural. Even if you're Krishna conscious, there's something natural about lamenting that such tragic things happen, that there even is such a world where such things happen, that others are suffering. A Krishna conscious person does feel bad that people are suffering. And yet, a Krishna conscious person has spiritual knowledge, and therefore his or her feelings ultimately take a spiritual bent and lead to further enlightenment and ultimate happiness. Both for the spiritual practitioner and for others. So, any questions on these points? Yes. Good point. Yeah. That's the standard greeting in the Bhagavatam or the Mahabharata. When you meet someone, is everything all right? No problems? They actually say this. No problem. How's your health? And so on and so forth. How's your family? They always ask about the family. In other words, it's like the real world. Yes, back there. Hang out with compassionate people. Let's say if you notice that let's say you want to be a doctor. You hang out with doctors. That's called medical school. Isn't it? I mean, I'm using sort of a slang expression here. But association. There's an old saying, a man is known by the company he keeps. So if we want to be compassionate, then whatever you want to be, you've got to associate with people that are what you want to be. Yes. That's interesting. The difference between compassion and lamenting. Well, think of the word compassion, which has a direct literal equivalent in Sanskrit, which is anukampa. Come, or con, if you know Latin languages, means with, and passion means feeling. And actually, passion, like if you know the Christian use of the passion of Jesus, it actually comes, I think, from a Latin verb, which means to suffer also. So compassion literally means to sort of suffer with someone, to suffer along with them. And so it's a type of empathy where their suffering also affects you. lamentation. Krishna, of course, says to be free from lamentation and hankering, but I think that we can make a distinction here. It's one thing to lament selfishly, and there is such a thing as selfish lamentation. I mean, there's one funny scene, actually, there's a movie called an adaptation of Little Women by Louisa May Alcott. Some of you may have seen or will see soon. And there's one scene where it's sort of a distinguished New England family around the 1860s has fallen on hard times, and the father's away at war. And so they need to send their mother, I think, to take care of their father who's in the hospital, and they have no money. So one of the daughters, one of the little women, the daughters, comes home and with some money to send the mother. And how'd you get this money? Oh, she cut her hair. She had this beautiful long hair and she cut it. So then in a scene a little while later, she's crying and her older sister says, "You crying for father?" She said, "No, for my hair." Sorry. So the idea, there is such a thing as selfish lamentation. You can lament just because your selfish purposes weren't achieved. And you can lament because someone else's selfish purposes weren't achieved. For example, in a war, you can lament, or in a football game, our team lost, in other words, there's a type of lamentation which is based on some type of material conception of life. I am my body, or these are my people, and those aren't my people. It's the kind of identification which requires you to exclude. It's the kind of inclusion which requires exclusion. In other words, to be a nationalist, you have to have a strong sense that all those people out there are foreigners. So there is a type of inclusiveness which requires an exclusiveness. And so the lamentations, which are based on that type of inclusive, exclusive consciousness, I think are imperfect. There's a type of lamentation which can occur in a pure spiritual mind where you simply feel sorry for someone. You're grieving for someone, not because they are my people as opposed to those people, the outsiders, the others, but without any sense of insider, outsider, without any sense of, who's in and who's out, you simply grieve for someone because they're suffering. And so I think that kind of lamentation or that kind of empathy or compassion is compatible with Krishna consciousness. Dravida?
Yeah.
Yes. Because Arjuna was not lamenting spiritually. He was not lamenting spiritually. He was lamenting his lamentation.